And welcome to the Buckmaster Show. It is the 29th of March, 2011, a Tuesday. I am Bill Buckmaster, your host for the Buckmaster Show on KJLL 1330 and always on the World Wide Web at buckmastershow.com. We're live weekday mornings, 9 to 10, then we re-air the program from 7 to 8 p.m. here on KJLL. The lineup for today's show includes a leadoff newsmaker interview with Sandy Barr of the Sierra Club in Arizona. Then we talk with a former candidate for state mine inspector who is now on a one-man crusade to clean up thousands of abandoned mines in Arizona. At the bottom of the hour, earthquake expert Susan Beck joins us to preview tonight's forum at Centennial Hall in the University of Arizona campus on the Japan earthquake. And we close out the show with columnist Martin Wolf of the Financial Times in London talking about his column, China on the Brink of Ruling the World. The Buckmaster Show is primarily interview-driven, but it is a talk show, and that means there's room for you always, the listener, for your comments and questions. Call us on the Buckmaster Show live line at 529-3508. Supporters of Arizona's state parks are furious over provisions in the Senate budget that transfers park money to the state's general fund and mandates that at least one profitable recreational area be managed by the private sector, leading the charge to get lawmakers to reconsider killing the Arizona park system is Sandy Barr. Ms. Barr is the director of the Sierra Club's Grand Canyon chapter, and she joins us now from her Phoenix office on the Buckmaster Show live line. Sandy Barr, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
How serious is this threat to the park system?
It's a very serious threat. We've seen over the last 10 years the park system really got less and less support, and in fact currently our park system gets no general fund support, and then in the last 2 years they've critically cut parks, taking away dollars that are generated by the fees that we pay when we go into parks, and sweeping a number of the other special funds that they have. And of course, in this most current budget proposal, trying to force them to privatize certain parks without ensuring that it's a good deal, number one, or that it's lawful. And that's really one of the, one of the telling things about this legislature is they don't seem to be concerned about whether measures are constitutional or lawful.
The impact of the Senate budget on Arizona parks has really gotten very little attention as lawmakers focus on the big ticket items such as education and cuts to social services. The $8.1 billion Senate plan passed earlier this month proposes $1.5 billion in spending reductions. The parks fund, does that seem like an easy target for lawmakers hitting the state parks?
It is. There are a couple of reasons. Well, first of all, parks has always been hit by the legislature in tough times. For some reason, they have issues with parks, but in recent years, it's gotten even worse. And when you're talking about the huge cuts that they're making to K through 12 education and the universities, it really gets lost in that discussion. And I think it's important to point out, though, that what they're talking about cutting in the big scheme of things in this overall budget is nothing. And what these parks generate for local economies is much greater than what they're cutting. And you know, what Parks has done is gone out and developed these partnerships with local communities, with some nonprofits, a number of volunteer groups, and they have these contractual commitments where they're fulfilling part of it and the local community is fulfilling the other part of the contract. this budget would make it so they could not fulfill those contracts. It would result in more parks being shut down, and it would force parks to accept a bad deal relative to contracting with someone for one park that is profitable and one park that isn't. First of all, they're probably not going to get anyone who wants a non-profitable park. And second of all, it has this artificial deadline of February 1st, 2012. So no matter how bad the deal was, they would have to go ahead and do that. So it's there's so many problems with this budget and relative to everything, but relative to parks and environmental programs, it's a disaster.
It's about 12 minutes past the hour on the Buckmaster Show. Sandy Barr of the Sierra Club, the Grand Canyon chapter, is with us on the Buckmaster Show live line. The Arizonans love their park system. The park system is composed of 30 parks, draws more than 2 million visitors a year. The system, however, has not received a dime of general fund revenue since December of 2009. The system has lost more than $72 million in funding over the past 3 years as lawmakers work to close the ongoing budget gap. You know, it strikes me, here are the parks, the jewels. We're living in the Grand Canyon State, one of the most beautiful places on earth. Rather than cutting parks, why aren't we improving parks and making this them a showplace as they should be?
Absolutely. There are so many reasons for investing in parks, and especially now in a tough economy. One of the things that contributes significantly to our state economy is tourism. These state parks are very popular with tourists, of course popular with people who live here as well. But people come and they camp in the parks, and they, you know, who doesn't stop by Picacho Peak to see wildflowers? And you know, Karchner Caverns is a huge draw for people from not just around the country but around the world. And instead of looking at these parks as an asset, both from a cultural and natural perspective, but also economically, the state legislature seems to have a vendetta against the park system. And, you know, all I can figure out from what they're doing is that they see parks as part of government, and because of that, they are targeting, trying to eliminate it instead of looking at the park system as this wonderful asset to our state, you know, and to future generations. And it's just, to me, is just criminal what they're doing to the park system.
Well, we keep hearing about supporting privatization for the state to consider the private sector to find creative opportunities to bring in extra revenue. Can you point to any parks that have been successful with this private partnership?
Well, I guess the key issue with this privatization question is what do people mean by privatization? Now, there have been successful programs to have a concession at a park. So a private entity that runs a campground or a gift shop or something like that. But the key is that the parks must be, they are public assets. We can't give them away to private entities. That, first of all, would be a violation of the gift clause, but in our Constitution. But these are, you know, they're public assets, and so we need to make sure that, you know, we look at protection of the resources first. There are just wonderful cultural resources in many of these parks, from, you know, the Tubac Presidio to Homolivi ruins, the amazing places, natural areas, the Verde Greenway. There are, you know, we need to make sure that we're taking care of those for now and for future generations. But we also need to make sure that that we're not just saying, oh, okay, you can manage these parks and derive as much money as possible and not worry about what happens to the condition of the parks.
Well, it looks like the supporters for the parks don't have much hope with the Senate. That's a done deal. So I understand some are pinning their hopes on the governor's office. She told the Arizona Republic that the Senate privatization proposal just doesn't make any sense. So do you think the governor might be an ally here?
Well, I think that we really need to push the Arizona House of Representatives to get this pulled out of the budget. I would be very concerned about a budget that went to the governor's desk that had this in there, because while she says she doesn't support it, a key question is, would she actually veto a budget because of it? And I certainly wouldn't want to risk the park system to that veto, and so definitely need to try and get it pulled from the budget before it reaches her desk. But people need to continue to let both their legislators know and the governor know that this is something that's important to them. It's not a question of will you fund parks or education, which I know the legislators, they always try to, you know, make it be, okay, where do you want us to take this money? And the bottom line is, all we're saying is, let the parks keep the money that we pay when we go into these parks, with the understanding that that money is going to support them, and let them continue these partnerships to keep the parks open and protected and available for the people of Arizona. And in the meantime, all of us need to continue to work to find a sustainable way to fund the park system. Last year, we were part of an effort to propose putting a small fee on the vehicle license for automobiles in Arizona, a $12 fee that would enable anyone with an Arizona license plate to get into all of the parks for free, and that also would fund parks in a sustainable manner. They'd be able to do the operation, the maintenance, and keep these parks protected and open. The legislature would not let that move forward.
Sandy Barr from the Sierra Club, thank you very much for being on the Buckmaster Show. Have a great day.
Thanks, you too.
Thanks Bye-bye. A lot. Coming up next, we'll be looking at the issue of abandoned mine shafts in the state of Arizona. Stay with us on the Buckmaster Show.
The Arizona Inn is the only Tucson hotel named by Travel and Leisure magazine as one of the top 500 hotels in the world for 2011. Located in Midtown, close to the University of Arizona, the Arizona Inn is located at 2200 East Elm Street and on the web at arizonainn.com. The Arizona Inn maintains AAA Four Diamond status for both the hotel and dining room, with Chef Allison serving up breakfast, lunch, and dinner daily, with a featured menu and seasonal favorites. And because the Arizona Inn is listed on the National Register of Historic Places, founded by Arizona's first Congresswoman, Isabella Greenway, the Arizona Inn provides an historic backdrop for your next special event. Arizona Inn is the perfect setting for weddings, anniversary celebrations, or your next business meeting. And you can make your reservations online at arizonainn.com. The Arizona Inn, luxury and elegance in the heart of Tucson.
Sarnoff Artist Materials is your one-stop store for fine and graphic artist supplies, framing, stationery, and Mont Blanc and other top-of-the-line writing instruments. Order online at sarnoffart.com or visit owner-operator Henry Sarnoff and his store staffed by artists, for artists, and those who seek the finest quality in everything art-related. Sarnoff Artist Materials, 2504 North Campbell, three blocks north of Grant, and always at sarnoffart.com.
Taste pizza as it was meant to be at Vero More, Tucson's only certified authentic Neapolitan pizza, topped with the finest, freshest quality ingredients. Enjoy casual yet upscale dining while sampling our extensive boutique wine list. Vero More in Tucson at North Swan and Camp Lowell, Dove Mountain in Marana, and on the web at veromorepizza.com. And coming soon, Noble Hops, Tucson's first gastro pub.
Let Karimi Oriental Rugs keep your valuable area rugs looking like new with Tucson's finest cleaning, repair, and restoration services. Karimi specializes in restoring antique, silk, and Navajo rugs with 100% satisfaction guarantee. Karimi Oriental Rugs appraises and purchases quality rugs and offers a vast selection of hand-woven rugs from around the world. Be sure to stop by Karimi Oriental Rugs at Fort Lowland Dodge or on the web at KarimiOrientalRugs.com.
For more than 40 years, Pima Community College has helped our citizens realize their dreams, prepare for meaningful employment, improve their quality of life, and create a better community. We haven't done it alone. Your continuing investment in and support of education has made it possible for us to prepare hundreds of thousands of Southern Arizonans for jobs. Today's Pima Community College students will be tomorrow's firefighters, nurses, police officers, teachers, and small business owners, the backbone of a literate, prosperous, thriving Tucson and Pima County. During these extraordinarily tough times, our funding is in serious jeopardy. And as budgets get even tighter, we'll have to cut back services just when people need us the most. So please support us in our ongoing effort to build a better tomorrow. Help us provide the education and resources that the people of Pima County need today. For more information, contact us at 206-4500 or visit us on the web at pima.edu. Pima Community College, developing our community through learning.
Imagine a jewelry store that is both sophisticated and organic, where Tucson's rich cultural heritage mingles with contemporary design. We invite you to Veer Jewelers, where our commitment to customer service is surpassed only by our reputation for creating inspired custom jewelry that is as unique as our customers. At Veer Jewelers, you are warmly welcomed, whether you are bringing in an heirloom for repair or design, replacing a watch battery, or shopping for a special gift. Visit our unique showroom, centrally located on Campbell, just north of Grant, or visit our website at veerjewelers.com. Veer Jewelers, Tucson's trusted jeweler for more than 25 years.
Coming up on 24 minutes past the hour on the Buckmaster Show, Arizona is littered with thousands of abandoned mine shafts. Joining us on the Buckmaster Show is Manuel Cruz. Mr. Cruz ran an unsuccessful campaign last November to become Arizona's mine inspector. Mr. Cruz is on a crusade to get Arizona's abandoned mine issue under control, and he was going to join us here live in the studio, but unfortunately there was a traffic tie-up on I-10, so Manuel Cruz is on the cell phone by the side of the road. Mr. Cruz, thanks for being with us.
Great to be here, Bill. Thank you.
How bad is this mine shaft issue?
It's very bad. We have a documented 10,000 abandoned mines, with a third of those deemed dangerous, where folks enjoy Arizona. And they estimate over 100,000 in Arizona. And like you said, I did run for state mine inspector. But during my campaign, I talked about these abandoned mines. And I vowed to close as many of these abandoned mines down as I could. And even though I didn't win the bid for mine inspector, I still planned on keeping that promise. And so I've started a nonprofit organization called the Abandoned Mine Safety Organization. And it's dedicated to closing down abandoned mines and promoting abandoned mine safety education.
It just seems like it's a monumental task, you know, these thousands of mine shafts. Do they pose, most of them, a huge safety threat?
They do. And the problem that we're having is within the state budget, there's not enough money to properly close these down in great value. So that's why I'm helping out with the blessing of the current state mine inspector. And we're going to be starting our first abandoned mine closure project. We'll be in Globe. We're going to close down seven in the beginning all at once. They've got seven abandoned mines of variations in one of their parks in Globe. So that's our first project.
That was picked because it is in a park situation, and of course the safety hazard is huge, I guess, there. Are many of these mines in or near safe, or where people recreate?
Absolutely. Our biggest areas are Pima County, Maricopa County, and Mojave County. And as the population grows, they just get closer and closer to these abandoned mines.
Tell me about the GLOBE effort. How do you close a mine? What do you use? What kind of technique is involved there?
We have seven that are different. Some of them are horizontal, some of them are vertical. So we'll be blasting the horizontal ones closed. We'll be using a technique called rock bolting for some deep vertical shafts that are 100 plus feet deep, which is kind of using rebar and concrete and drilling rods into the circumference of the abandoned mines to cap those off and get those permanently closed.
Manuel Cruz is on the Buckmaster Show live line. He has started a campaign, a nonprofit, to get this abandoned mine issue to bring it more to the center stage in the consciousness of Arizonans. How about signage over these mines? Are most of them unsigned?
Most of them are unsigned. Some have fences. Most of them don't. As we document them, as we GPS them, if there's money, we put a sign. That's actually the state mine inspector. But what we're trying to do is permanently close every single mine that we can. Our feeling is that if we close a mine, we've potentially saved one life from falling into one of these dangerous obstacles. So that's why we've started this abandoned mine safety organization. We've got a website, abandonedminesafety.org, and there's some really good educational material on there. There's some videos and other things, materials on there that really talk about some of the hazards, such as the gases that build up in these mines and can pose a hazard. Of course, the fall hazards, along with old explosives, sometimes are left in there from years and years, and they're very unstable. And you get in there, and you can get into some problems. So there's so many different aspects of why these things are dangerous.
As I recall from the campaign with Joe Hart, the current mine inspector, you have a mining background. Is that why that led you to this abandoned mine issue?
Yes. I've been in the mining business for over a decade and a half, and I've actually closed down abandoned mines. I've opened up new ones. But what really pulled the heartstring is when the two little girls in Chloride, Arizona, fell into an abandoned mine and one lost their life and the other one was almost paralyzed. That really brought it to the forefront of this issue and why it's so important that we close these down, because we want to keep our kids safe, our Arizonans safe. As Arizona grows, that we just become closer and closer to these obstacles.
Manuel Cruz, keep us posted when you have another project, perhaps close here to home here in Pima County. Thanks a lot and good luck. AbandonedMindSafety.org is your website. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And anyone, we're hoping to get donations from any of your listeners and anyone else that can help make a difference.
Got to go. Thank you very much. Bottom of the hour on the Buckmaster Show. Stay with us.
This is Tucson's Jolt.
This is a free exchange of ideas.
AM 1330, KJLL.
The American people deserve no less.
South Tucson.
CNN Radio, I'm Bill Caiaccio. Witnesses say Muammar Gaddafi's forces are pounding the Libyan city of Misrata.
Heavy shelling, using tanks, using mortar bombs. In all directions now.
Coalition planes apparently dropped more bombs in Tripoli today. CNN's Nick Robertson says he heard three loud explosions in the capital. More than 20 people were killed when attackers stormed a government building in northern Iraq. Police say dozens of people are being held hostage inside the building in Tikrit. There was a protest against Walmart outside the U.S. Supreme Court today. The court heard arguments in a major pay discrimination case. There should be a ruling by June. Home prices across the country are close to their lows of 2009. An index of 20 major markets shows prices fell in January for the sixth month in a row. The most trusted name in news. This is CNN Radio.
Attention parents. If your son is 11 to 17 years old and exhibits oppositional or defiant behavior patterns, we want to prove that our best-selling child behavior program, The Total Transformation, will work for you. And we're willing to give it to you for free. For a limited time, we are offering the entire program free if you're the parent of an 11 to 17-year-old male child as part of a national market research project. If you're struggling with disrespect, backtalk, lying, school problems, or defiant behavior, you can get the total transformation free by calling 1-800-259-1466. Call now and find out how you can participate in this limited-time market research project. By sending in your results, you'll get our $300 child behavior program for free. Limited number of free programs available. Call now 1-800-259-1466. 1-800-259-1466. That's 1-800-259-1466. 1-800-259-1466.
For contractors looking to cut costs, the Home Depot is a great place to start. Where right now we've got new lower prices on Weather Shield pressure treated decking. The water repellent coating means you won't have to stain or seal it for up to a year after you install it. So you save money and man hours. That's big savings that could help lower your bids, which will help you win more business so you can build a stronger one. More saving, more doing. That's the power of the Home Depot.
Listed on the National Register of Historic Places and founded by Isabella Greenway, Arizona's first congresswoman, the Arizona Inn is still the standard bearer for luxury hospitality in Midtown Tucson, just minutes from the University of Arizona. Founded in 1930, the Arizona Inn continues to win top honors for hospitality and dining. Travel and Leisure magazine names the Arizona Inn one of the top 500 hotels in the world for 2011. And the Arizona Inn is proud of its AAA four diamond status for both the hotel and dining room. Whether it's for breakfast, lunch, or dinner, or a private event, you can count on Chef Allison's featured seasonal culinary creations to please. The Arizona Inn, a special oasis of hospitality in Midtown Tucson, 2200 East Elm, and on the web at arizonainn.com.
With 30 projects under construction, including work at La Cañada Drive and the First Avenue bus pullouts, the Regional Transportation Authority is delivering our promise to you already. RTA has completed 174 projects, including 5 major roadways, and launched transit services like Sun Express and Sun Shuttle. Your tax dollars are creating jobs and making travel around our region faster and safer. Please be careful of workers in those areas and obey all traffic signs. The RTA, delivering our promise to you.
Vero Amore presents Tucson's only certified authentic Neapolitan pizza using fresh homemade mozzarella and the finest quality toppings. Taste pizza as it was meant to be at Vero Amore, casual yet upscale dining with an extensive boutique wine list. Vero Amore in Tucson at North Swan and Cap Lowell, Dove Mountain in Marana, and on the web at veroamorepizza.com. Coming soon, Noble Hops, Tucson's first gastro pub.
Hi, I'm Mark Sublett, owner of Medicine Man Gallery, and I'd like to invite you to come visit me. Medicine Man Gallery is located at 7000 East Tinka Verde, at the southwest corner of Tinka Verde and Sabino Canyon, and online at medicinemangallery.com. With 12,000 square feet of exhibit space, we have a wide array of American paintings, antique Indian art, and contemporary modern art by some of the masters of the West, including Ed Mell, John Moyers, and Maynard Dixon. If you have old Indian art or American paintings you'd like to sell or consign, call me for a free evaluation, as we're always looking to add to our collection. If you can't visit us on Tinka Verde, then visit us online. We have over 6,000 objects to view at medicinemangallery.com. So come visit me, Mark Sublett, at Medicine Man Gallery on the corner of Tinka Verde and Sabino Canyon, where there's always something new to see.
University of Arizona is staging a free and open science forum at Centennial Hall tonight, 6 o'clock, to answer questions from the community about the aftermath of the Japanese earthquake, the tsunami, and the nuclear crisis in Japan. Among the scientists
Taking part in the discussion will be Dr. Seismologist Susan Beck, Professor of Geosciences at the University of Arizona. Dr. Beck has special expertise in plate tectonics and subduction zones. Susan, good to see you.
Thank you, Bill.
Talk to me about when you first heard about this earthquake. What was your first reaction?
Well, when I first heard about this earthquake and saw how large it was, I was just horrified. You really hate to see these kinds of big earthquakes. But I did know that in many ways Japan is pretty well prepared for earthquakes because they've had a lot. So even though it's been horrendous, it could have been worse. And I also knew that Japan is got some of the best seismic instruments of anywhere in the world. And so there will be some lessons to learn from this earthquake when all is said and done.
How about our seismic information at the University of Arizona? What did it pick up?
Yeah, we have a seismic station in the Catalinas, as you know, and it picked up this earthquake. The first P wave that got to us took 12 minutes. So after the earthquake happened in Japan, it took 12 minutes for it to propagate across the Pacific. And
it only took 12 minutes?
For the first arrival, it only took 12 minutes because these waves travel through the Earth pretty fast. And then after that, we got other seismic arrivals coming in. And the surface waves that go around the surface of the Earth continued on for 10 or 12 hours. So we were getting packets of energy moving the ground in Tucson for over 12 hours after that earthquake. Now, those motions were really small, so we couldn't feel them, but it recorded this earthquake very well.
You know, when it comes to earthquakes, there'd been the big earthquake down in Christchurch, New Zealand, with lots of damage. However, if you look at the Richter scale reading on that one, it was considerably less than the Japanese earthquake. I guess it has to do with how close the earthquake is to the surface. Is that a generalization that's fairly accurate?
Yeah, it's a function of how close the population center is to the earthquake, and if it's very shallow. So in Christchurch, the earthquake was on land and just went right through Christchurch. So people were essentially at ground zero, much like Haiti earthquake. That fault went right through Port-au-Prince. The Japan earthquake was further offshore. But maybe even more important than that also are the side effects, the ground. If you're on hard bedrock, shaking isn't quite as bad. If you're on soft sediments that are saturated with water, the shaking gets amplified. And that's what happened in Christchurch. That part of town damaged really had some waves amplified.
The tsunami situation, it's very hard to predict. And I know there's a very elaborate tsunami warning system that goes around the so-called Ring of Fire down along the South American coast up through Indonesia. Has that system paid off in its results?
Absolutely. So when an earthquake happens underwater, it offsets the seafloor and generates a tsunami. And so the warning system monitors earthquakes globally, and when they see an earthquake is shallow and underwater and big, it gets flagged. But in addition to that, there are these systems you're referring to that are out in the ocean, and they're connected to sensors in the water column, and they actually pick up the tsunami wave propagating out, and they can verify or confirm that a tsunami has been generated. And so for much of the Pacific, that gives them many hours of warning. For example, this Japan earthquake took about 10 hours before it hit the west coast of the U.S. Of course, if you're in Japan, it's much worse. They might have had, 10 minutes to an hour, depending on where they were. But even that is a lot of warning.
I want to talk a bit about the subduction zone, the biggest subduction. What is a subduction zone? And I guess the biggest one is not far away here in the United States, off the coast of Washington and Oregon.
Yeah, a subduction zone is a type of plate boundary. The Earth has these rigid plates that are moving slowly. We can measure that with GPS. And subduction zone is where one plate goes down beneath another. And Japan has one of those. Alaska has one offshore. And so does the Pacific Northwest, Oregon and Washington. There's a plate going down underneath. And where those plates touch, they get locked up. And eventually, the stresses build up and they fail. And that's when you get a big earthquake.
And there's been a big one back in the 1700s in that Washington, Oregon area, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So they may be due.
Yeah, they probably are due. And we don't know if it'll happen next week or in 10 years or 50 years, but they are due. And that earthquake in 1700 produced a tsunami that made it to Japan. And back then, Japan had tidal gauges that recorded it, and they could tell from the way it hit Japan that it came from the Washington-Oregon coast. So we don't know exactly the size, but it was probably in the high eights, could have even been close to a nine.
Speaking of overdue, many folks point to Southern California, ready for the big one. I know that scientists have been mapping the San Andreas Fault. We really can't predict earthquakes, can we?
No, we really can't predict earthquakes. We know that there are faults like the San Andreas or subduction zones that have long histories of earthquakes. So we know they're going to happen again. And we tend to think if it's been a while, we better be even more prepared. But the fact is, we just cannot predict earthquakes. So we've got to be prepared.
And of course, folks, well, maybe they don't realize it, but there was an earthquake, and actually a fairly big one, that actually damaged the San Javier del Bac mission. I'm trying to think, is it
1887. Yeah, it was just south of Douglas, Arizona, and it was felt throughout southern Arizona. It was estimated to be a magnitude 7.4. There's still a big fault scarp down there where the ground is offset that's pretty impressive. And it shook southern Arizona quite hard. There were a lot of rock falls. Even some fires started. If you read the old newspaper accounts, it was pretty impressive.
I did read a little bit about that earthquake, and I think the old-timers said that the Catalinas were covered in dust for weeks after that earthquake.
Yeah, yeah. The big rock falls just put a lot of dust in the air.
So getting back to tonight's forum, if anyone has any questions, this would be a great time to come out and talk about earthquakes.
That's right. The forum is designed for us to say a little bit about each area of the earthquake or the aftermath, and then people in the audience can ask questions, and we hope there'll be plenty of time for that.
What's the biggest question you always get about earthquakes?
Well, I think the biggest question I get asked is, could it happen to us? How does it relate to Arizona or to the U.S.? People are interested in the science of earthquakes, but ultimately it gets back to how does it impact us? And, you know, we can talk about earthquakes in Arizona. It's fairly low risk, but there are a few like this 1887, and so I think no matter where you live, you really want to be prepared for natural disasters.
And I think if the big one were to hit in Southern California, there could be all sorts of economic implications, supplies coming in from the West Coast. We could have a cutoff of goods that we need.
Yeah, we're really reliant on transportation from Southern California. It's a big port. A lot of things come in and come to Arizona and to the U.S., so there could be some disruption. We saw a little bit of that in 1994 after the Northridge earthquake. There was a little bit of disruption, you know, not major, but it was a concern.
A big earthquake, the so-called big one in Southern California, I guess we would feel that here in Arizona, wouldn't we?
We
could
feel it.
If it was over, say, eight?
Yeah, we could feel it, particularly if you live over by Yuma near the California border. You would likely feel it. It's hard to say if we'd feel it here in Tucson. It depends, again, how big it is and some other characteristics. But
we need to be prepared. And what should we do to prepare for an earthquake?
Well, I think you want to think about what to do before, during, and after an earthquake. And there's a lot of good information on this. But before, you want to have emergency kits, you know, water, flashlight, batteries, radio, a little food. But you also want to, you know, make sure things aren't going to topple down on you and have a little bit of a plan if it happens. Get in a doorway, get away from windows, and know how to turn the gas off in your house, because for earthquakes, one of the biggest hazards are gas lines break and you have fires. So there are things you can do. If you live in California or somewhere else, you might want to check with your emergency management plans and think about it a little more.
Seismologist Susan Beck from the University of Arizona. She will be taking part in a forum tonight at 6 o'clock at Centennial Hall. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot. This is the Buckmaster Show, coming up now on 46 minutes past the hour.
Tucson's Regional Transportation Authority uses your tax dollars to create jobs and make local travel faster and safer. Transit services like Sun Express and Sun Shuttle and the completion of 5 major roadways are examples of how RTA is delivering on our promises to you. With 174 projects completed and 30 under construction, such as the First Avenue bus pullouts and La Canada Drive, RTA wants to remind you to be careful of road workers and to obey all traffic signs. RTA, delivering our promises to you.
From antique to contemporary, Persia to Pakistan, Tibet to Turkey, Karimi Oriental Rugs brings the world to Tucson at the corner of East Fort Lowell and Dodge. Owner-operator Amir Karimi personally selects the world's finest exquisite hand-woven rugs. Sale, purchase, wash, repair, restore, and appraise. East Fort Lowell and Dodge for Karimi Oriental Rugs and KarimiOrientalRugs.com.
Hi, I'm Mark Sublett, owner of Medicine Man Gallery, and I'd like to invite you to come visit me. Medicine Man Gallery is located at 7000 East Tinkerverde, at the southwest corner of Tinkerverde and Sabino Canyon, and online at medicinemangallery.com. With 12,000 square feet of exhibit space, we have a wide array of American paintings, antique Indian art, and contemporary modern art by some of the masters of the West, including Ed Nell, John Moyers, and Maynard Dixon. If you have old Indian art or American paintings you'd like to sell or consign, call me for a free evaluation, as we're always looking to add to our collection. If you can't visit us on Tankerverde, then visit us online. We have over 6,000 objects to view at medicinemangallery.com. So come visit me, Mark Sublett, at Medicine Man Gallery, on the corner of Tankerverde and Sabino Canyon, where there's always something new to see.
Sarnoff Artist Materials is Tucson's award-winning destination for everything art-related, including fine and graphic artist supplies, framing, stationery, and the world's best writing instruments. Visit owner-operator artist Henry Sarnoff at 2504 North Campbell, 3 blocks north of Grant, and always at the easy-to-navigate website sarnoffart.com. Because it takes an artist to know an artist's needs.
How China Should Rule the World is the title of a recent major piece in the Financial Times by writer Martin Wolf, who we spoke earlier with this morning from his office at the Financial Times in London. Martin Wolf joins us now on the Buckmaster Show live line from the Financial Times offices in London. Mr. Wolf, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
You say that reform and opening up has been the China mantra for more than 3 decades. The result has not only been the emergence of a new economic superpower, but of one highly integrated into the world economy. So, in your opinion, how should China be using its influence?
Well, the main argument of this column, which of course had a very deliberately provocative headline, which you've just repeated, is that China has emerged now as both a very open economy and a very integrated economy. This now gives it great influence, and it has to decide, in principle, what sort of power it's going to be. And my dominant argument is that China has benefited from an open and liberal world economy, relatively liberal trade, relatively free movement of capital, open markets for resources. And I'm arguing that that this system, which of course we owe essentially to the United States in the last 60 years, is very powerfully in the interests of China, and China should act in ways that strengthen, reinforce, and promote it, rather than risk undermining it. So that's the core argument of this piece.
This piece came out of a speech that you delivered at China's Development Forum in Beijing. How was this accepted?
I was very interested in the general reaction. The Western participants, predominantly American, though not exclusively so, were, I think, entirely in agreement, interestingly. And the reaction that I have received from the Chinese people who attended this, it was... I thought quite surprisingly positive. It's clear that China has now got to the point, it's the second biggest economy in the world. It's now the largest exporter in the world. So it's now getting to the point when it really does have to think what its responsibilities for the system as a whole are. And I think there is at least a strong current of opinion that China has to strengthen and promote the system that has benefited it. But it is also fair to note there are plenty of other currents of opinion which are more inward-looking, more nationalist, more suspicious of the West, more determined to preserve every ounce of freedom of maneuver for China. And I think there's a sort of open battle that will now emerge over the next 10, 15 years about the sort of China there will be and how it will fit into the world.
Martin Wolf is talking with us from London. The Financial Times office is there. He is a columnist for the Financial Times. Mr. Wolf, I don't know if you saw the Robert Kaplan piece in the Wall Street Journal over the weekend. Mr. Kaplan is a senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security and a correspondent for The Atlantic. He had some rather controversial things to say about China, including every time he says the United States intervenes somewhere, it quickens the pace at which China, whose leaders relish obscurity in international affairs, closes the gap with the United States. What do you think of that?
That's a slightly puzzling sentence, and I'm not quite sure what he has in mind. I haven't read the piece, I'm afraid, though I'm very familiar with his general writings. Where I agree is that so far, China has largely taken the view that it should focus, not exclusively, but that it should focus on its internal development, that it should lie low and be relatively obscure in the world's view until it emerges with far greater power, while it has shown some substantial assertiveness in its near neighborhood. It is a long way yet from being willing to assert itself in the world as a whole. That's just one aspect of the very slow movement of China towards world power status. I think it is probably true that when it sees the West intervening, there are probably people in China who think to themselves, well, if the West feel they're entitled to do this sort of thing, maybe we're entitled to do this sort of thing too. And there is some risk, I think, of China following this particular example. I should stress, however, that in my column, I was focusing only on economics and not on geopolitics, though, of course, the latter is very, very important. And it was on China's role as a trading power, as a financial power, as a consumer of resources, as part of the global monetary system that I was focusing, and not on China as a great power in the more conventional sense.
Let's go back to your column and talk about economics. It's really amazing that China is the largest importer of many commodities and the price setter for many products. And I didn't realize until after reading your column that China owns a third of world currency reserves.
That is correct. It owns about $3 trillion out of a total of $9 trillion. So and this is about 50% of its GDP. It should be said, of course, that the U.S. doesn't own any or owns almost no currency reserves, and as many have pointed out, not much gold reserves anymore either, because, of course, the United States can print currency reserves since the dollar is the world's principal reserve currency. But if you put the U.S. aside for the moment and the Eurozone, which also has a reserve currency, though a smaller one, China is in a class of its own in terms of the sheer scale of its currency reserves. And that, of course, provided it with a huge sort of cushion in the crisis. It was one of the reasons it could cope with the financial crisis so well. So it's a very important feature of the way China has integrated within the world system over the last decade.
On the Buckmaster Show live line, Martin Wolf, Financial Times writer and columnist, talking with us from London. We have about 3.5 minutes to go, and I want to bring up the fact that so many Americans complain when they go to the large discounters, Mr. Wolf, like Walmart and some of the others, that it seems like every product they pick up says made in China. Is that going to change at all with the situation with the dollar versus the Chinese currency?
Well, I think it will change in two or three different ways, some comfortable and some uncomfortable. There will be a very modest shift back of production to the U.S., but I don't think very much. More important is that production is going to shift from China to other emerging countries. China is becoming substantially more expensive to produce, and wages are now rising quite fast. And clearly, production of some goods, particularly garments, things like this, are now moving to other cheaper developing countries, Vietnam, Bangladesh, Indonesia, places with lower wages. So that's one part of the shift. There is, in addition, of course, China is upgrading itself. So it's getting more and more competitive in the middle of production. China is now the world's largest producer of motor vehicles and could well be a big exporter, I imagine, in the not-too-distant future. So that's going to be very uncomfortable. And as I mentioned, there should be some greater opportunities for U.S. investment, U.S. exports, along with U.S. investment in China. But the adjustment won't be solved simply by the currency adjustments.
It really is a fascinating combination, and as you point out, unprecedented, because here we have an economic power, a developing country that is still ruled by the Communist Party.
Yes, it's very disturbing, and it's not a situation, to tell you the truth, that I at all like. But unfortunately, it's the reality, and we have to adapt to it because we don't have the capacity simply to change it.
In the remaining few seconds, Mr. Wolf, what would you like folks to have taken away from the column, which, by the way, is readily available on the Internet under How China Should Rule the World? How would you
I think what I would like them to take away is they should ask themselves, well, China is becoming a great power. How do we think it will behave, and how do we think it should behave, and what can we do to influence it?
Martin Wolf, thank you very much. What can we look for, fans of the Financial Times? What are you working on right now?
I'm afraid it's probably not an issue of much interest to American readers. It's all about the future of the Eurozone and whether it will stay together.
Well, those of us who traveled to Europe were probably very concerned about the dollar going down against the euro. Thank you so much, Martin Wolf, for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Goodbye.
Bye-bye. Martin Wolf speaking with us from London, talking about his column, How China Should Rule the World. And the Buckmaster Show is brought to you in part by Flowers, Rieger & Associates, Certified Public Accountants. They are at 2919 East Broadway and on the web at flowersrieger.com. Flowers & Rieger is the CPA firm of the Buckmaster Show. Speaking of CPA Michael C. Flowers, he will be with us at about 9:30 on Thursday, so jot this phone number down, 529-3508. 529-3508. We'll be calling, taking your tax questions. So our tax tips segment with Michael C. Flowers, Thursday morning at 9:30. That's going to do it for the Buckmaster Show. I am Bill Buckmaster. You can check out our website, www.buckmastershow.com. Have a great day.
Tucson's Jolt. KJLL, South Tucson.